Wisconsin Supreme Court has reconvened. The Honorable Chief Justice of that committee is invited. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning. We have court with class here today and interns from Governor Evers' office. If you could please stand up so we can acknowledge you. Nice to have you here today. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Justice Rebecca Dallet will take a few minutes after the oral argument this morning if you have some time to stick around. So welcome. It's nice to have you here. Go ahead and have a seat. Second case we're calling this morning is State versus Grady, case number 23AP1464CR. Start with your appearances, please.
Christopher August.
Good morning.
I should stand up.
All right, good morning. All right, with that, the lineup I have is 25 minutes, followed by 30 minutes and 5 minutes on rebuttal, right? Okay, please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. We're here on what I think is a straightforward case involving fundamental fairness. The circuit court in this case had a constitutionally imposed duty to ensure Mr. Grady's meaningful access to counsel by facilitating a truly confidential line of communication between lawyer and client. To be clear, there were ample alternatives available which could have complied with this constitutional requirement. Instead, however, the circuit court chose a deficient procedure which violated Mr. Grady's right to due process of law and compels this court to reverse and remand for a new hearing on his ability to pay.
So there are a couple of issues here. There's due process, there's effective assistance of counsel. If you win on the due process issue, do we need to get to the ineffective assistance issue?
So my due process issue would be remanding for a new hearing on the ability. I do think that the ineffectiveness issue is dealing with a distinct legal issue, which would be whether counsel should have stipulated to the amount, the $1,000 amount. Obviously, counsel's position at the hearing was to stipulate to all the proposed amounts and only argue ability to pay. So I do think that they're separate issues, which would require separate analysis.
Isn't the remedy for both new restitution hearing?
That's correct, but I think the court would need to reach the stipulation issue because, again, if the court simply remanded it for a new hearing as it stood previously, there was a stipulation in effect to the amount. The only disputed issue was ability to pay. So I think the court would have to go that additional step and clarify whether it was correct for counsel to stipulate to that $1,000. So as to the first issue regarding the due process violation, the case law makes clear that access to counsel is an integral part of our legal system. The Seventh Circuit has discussed that access to counsel is tantamount to access to courts, and the United States Supreme Court has discussed the fundamental importance of that confidential channel of communication between lawyer and client. That's at the core of the access to counsel. In other words, for a person's access to counsel to be meaningful, they need to be able to realize that benefit and have that truly confidential, candid line of communication with their lawyer. In this case, however, Mr. Grady, my client, began this hearing at a distinct structural disadvantage. Mr. Grady was appearing by Zoom. He was the only person appearing by Zoom. Mr. Grady was an incarcerated person. He didn't have any freedom of movement. Everyone else was present in person. Now, I don't think that this arrangement necessarily is unconstitutional, but certainly it should have put the circuit court on notice. As the Massachusetts Supreme Court said in the Diaz case that I cited in the brief, that there's a potential here that there's going to be an issue with access to counsel. And certainly the technology makes clear that Mr. Grady was at the total mercy of the circuit court with respect to his ability to consult with and access his counsel. In other words, due to the structural way this hearing was set up, he could not simply pass a note. He couldn't whisper to his lawyer. The only way he could talk to his lawyer confidentially is if the circuit court took some affirmative step in order to facilitate and provide him that avenue to do so.
Well, he or his counsel could have asked the judge for that, and they didn't. Is that correct?
So I certainly understand the state's rhetorical strategy in this case to be, I think, to shift the blame. And I think that's a mistake, because at the end of the day, it's the circuit court which has both the power and the responsibility to structure hearings in its courtroom in a way that complies with constitutional guarantees. So the court is the one in this situation who has all of the power, has the power not only over the Zoom software of how people appear virtually, but has power over how people appear and how hearings are conducted in its courtroom. And the circuit court in this case made structural choices that were deficient and failed to accommodate Mr. Grady's ability to access his counsel.
So, Attorney August, so how would you, if you could write this, what would the holding be? Because you could see how this could be, this could be giant of what we're saying. This could be small. Like, what is it exactly that triggers this violation of due process?
So the deprivation of due process is inability for Mr. Grady to confidentially consult with his attorney. And that's due to the structural choices that the circuit court made. So I think
that's... So is it limited to Zoom?
So I think for the purposes of this case, we're dealing with Zoom, because I think Zoom has, I think, the biggest risks in this case. And Zoom is certainly something that has revolutionized our courts in Wisconsin. I think it's been a great technological advantage. It's made our courts more efficient. I certainly enjoy appearing by Zoom, but I think this court needs to make clear to lower courts that when litigants are appearing by Zoom, especially when they're appearing in this kind of hybrid procedure, which is frequently utilized with in-custody defendants, there is a risk and there is a need to proactively protect their ability to realize the benefit of counsel.
Does it matter that he was in custody? And does it matter that he was incompetent, had been found incompetent? Do either of those factor into what you see as our holding about violation of due process here?
So I think that those are factors in Mr. Grady's favor in this particular case. However, I don't think that they're essential to a finding that a due process violation occurred. I think the essential due process violation is court's denial of the ability to consult with counsel. And certainly in this situation, Mr. Grady's case, as I said, is heightened because, again,
I want this part's really important. So what I heard you say is the due process violation was the court's denial of Mr. Grady being able to consult with counsel.
Mm-hmm. Which, that's correct.
Okay. But this is, I worry that, trying to think of the best way to frame this. I don't see this. So it wasn't that he wasn't able to consult with counsel. It was that he wasn't able to do it in a confidential way.
That's a good clarification. And I appreciate the clarification that when I say consult with counsel, I think baked into that is this idea that for a consultation or for access to be meaningful, it needs to include that confidentiality.
So I know you want to finish your explanation, but I just want to stop at this point right here, because I'm wondering, would it have been better if the court said, don't consult at all? Because then there wouldn't have been the risk that there would have been a consultation that was not in confidence. Because it wasn't like your client didn't have a chance to consult with counsel before the hearing, but it seems like the judge took a break in the proceedings because there seemed to be some confusion, and he was talking out of turn, and the judge said, you want to take a break. So sometimes there's an overcorrection when we come down with the holding, and I think that part of what we need to do here perhaps is to help the circuit courts figure out where the lines are here. And so one way around this is just to say, once the Zoom hearing starts, there's not going to be any consultation with your attorney, because I can't make sure that that's going to happen confidentially.
So I think that that would be a due process violation of its own, because again, when we're looking at, I think the Luthi case from Washington is instructive on this, that when persons are in court, they need to be able to have a line of communication with their attorney. So just forbidding it is not a solution. I think,
but certainly forbidding Zoom would be then. I mean, then all of the, I mean, this works out pretty well for people who are in custody too, because transporting them back and forth from prison is, my understanding, no fun for those people in custody. It takes a while to get there. They get held in county jails instead of the prisons. I don't want our holding here, I guess. I understand what you're saying. My concern is that some judges are going to say, look, I'm reading this to say I just shouldn't even do Zoom hearings in these situations because the risk is too great.
So I'm certainly not here advocating to end Zoom hearings in the state of Wisconsin. As an employee of the state public defender, I want to make that very clear. But I think two things. And I would really look at Judge Maria Lazar's dissent in the Court of Appeals, because I think this tees it up pretty well. I think, number one, the essence of the violation is the untenable choice that was given to Mr. Grady, which is either consult in this non-confidential fashion, or as Your Honor has highlighted, don't consult with your lawyer at all. But number two, I would point out that I think, as Judge Maria Lazar does, the solution is pretty obvious. And it's a solution that I think even the judge in this case recognized, which is we have tools available which can effectuate access. We just need this court to emphasize that courts need to avail themselves of those tools.
Are there any limits on the use of those tools? For example, in this hearing, let's say that the judge said, okay, we'll have a little breakout room on Zoom for you and you'll have a confidential conversation. Then the hearing resumes and the defendant again says, oh, I want to talk to my lawyer. Doesn't the judge have some control over the course of the proceedings? How, and this is where what you're asking is very broad. You're asking us to declare a due process violation because the judge did not accommodate the request of the defendant, which actually there wasn't a request to speak confidentially, but I understand that you're arguing that the judge should have inferred that. But the hearings would never end with, and you're a state public defender, you know how this can go sometimes with your client interrupting you incessantly when you're trying to make an argument. But what is the judge supposed to do? Every single time he's got to stop the proceeding and have a breakout room? That would clog the calendars terribly.
So certainly the court has discretion in terms of how it's going to run its courtroom. I think there may be circumstances, as Your Honor points out, where maybe Zoom isn't working. And maybe the solution, as the circuit court recognized in this case, in an individual case, is it's best if everyone appears in person. But I think in this case, it's very clear. Mr. Grady wanted to speak to his attorney. He wasn't given the opportunity to do so in a meaningful fashion. That is a due process violation. Forcing Mr. Grady to forego that benefit is a structural deficit in this hearing that rendered it fundamentally unfair. And I do disagree with the proposition that Mr. Grady somehow failed in his duties to request a confidential consultation.
So I kind of see your argument, instead of a due process argument, more like a, we should exercise superintending authority to require certain things of our circuit courts, kind of like the court did when it required tape recording. Statements made by juveniles or things like that. Sort of a, there's a better way to do this, court, step in and tell trial courts how to do it, rather than a due process argument. Because he did consult with his lawyer and he had that opportunity. It just ended up being in a fashion where, after the fact, even though warned by the judge that everyone could hear him, and not to do it that way, he decided to talk to his lawyer and said things that he now wishes he wouldn't have.
So I certainly respect the court's superintending authority, and certainly if this court wanted to say something using that authority, it could. But I don't think that goes far enough in addressing the magnitude of the violation and the harm in this.
Why not? Because there is a place, I'm very intrigued by the chief's question, because What we would do if we follow what you're saying is, first of all, we have this mushy-gushy due process kind of parameter.
Mushy and gushy.
But more importantly, I think what we do in that setting is we take out the attorney's role, which I think was that the other question was getting to from Justice Bradley, with the that the attorneys do have a role in ensuring their clients are protected when it comes to confidentiality. And if we say it always is the judge's responsibility, then what are we doing with that piece? And whereas a superintending authority may be, this is how the courts should be run. This is a newer technology in the realm of technologies. It's been around, but this is how you need to do it to make sure that we are functioning in a way that is protective of defendants' rights.
So I think three things. Number one, I disagree that this is an imprecise standard or request that I make. Mr. Grady wanted to speak with his attorney. He had a right to meaningfully consult with his attorney. He was deprived that right. That's a due process violation. Number two, I also disagree that it's somehow improper to shift the blame away from the circuit court. The circuit court exercises tremendous power, and with that power obviously comes a responsibility to ensure that litigants in its Mr. Grady was not. That's a due process violation. Number three, I understand the frustration with trial counsel's inaction. I get it. I do. But that doesn't excuse the trial court's structural decisions in this case. The trial court acknowledged, I think, at the post-conviction motion hearing, that it was aware of alternatives. The circuit court certainly knew there were better ways to do this, and it didn't utilize those options. There was an easy way to avoid this error. It chose not to. That is a problem, and it merits reversal from this court, and it merits being labeled a due process violation, just as the Washington Supreme Court was concerned if we're putting clients in a box with a bailiff. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, weren't the Washington Supreme Court's Sixth Amendment rights? And why didn't you bring this under the Sixth Amendment if that's where your claim was? That's the difference, I think, between maybe Sixth Amendment and due process.
So I think there was also a discussion of due process in that context. I think I didn't bring it as a Sixth Amendment claim. It's here on a due process claim. I think that due process fits this better. Because again, we're talking about a structural choice, how the proceeding was set up, what procedure was used. And as this court and the United States Supreme Court have said, in assessing the sufficiency of a procedure, the touchstone is fundamental fairness. As the Seventh Circuit has told us, access to counsel, meaningful access to counsel, deprivation of that is a deprivation of that fundamental.
So what? Go ahead. Exactly what should be the process that is due?
Mr. Grady should have been able to confidentially consult with his attorney.
Tell me what the judge would do, because it seems a little Monday morning quarterback to say, you know, after the fact, he kind of continued to talk, even though the judge warned him, we can all hear you. You know, he has no responsibility at all to say anything or to ask that they have a, you know, confidential conversation. He has no responsibility for that at all. The judge should have known that despite the judge warning him, we can hear you. The judge should have known or forced him to do something differently. I mean, he spoke despite being told, we can all hear you.
So the issue is the imposition of the unreasonable choice on Mr. Grady. Mr. Grady was not proffered any alternatives. He was essentially placed in a position where he was told to choose between speaking in an open courtroom where everyone could hear him, including the judge and opposing counsel, or not consulting at all. And I do take issue with this idea that my client, who is an unsophisticated, mentally ill criminal defendant, is held responsible for not interjecting before going off the record and saying, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I wanted to clarify that. When I said I wanted to speak with my attorney, I wanted to have a confidential consultation in accord with my attorney-client privilege. I think that's an unrealistic standard, and it totally ignores the circuit court's obligations. And it is not Monday morning quarterbacking when, again, as Judge Lazar pointed out in her dissent, the alternatives are well known, The circuit court was well aware of the alternatives. It had other structural choices available. And for whatever reason, it failed to avail itself.
Counsel, you don't seem to want to be pinned down. And that's an appropriate response, I guess. But I'm going to try to pin you down. If you win, how should the court deal with Zoom hearings going forward?
So I think the holding from the court should, to a large extent, mirror some of what the Massachusetts Supreme Court had to say, which is to recognize, yes, Zoom has benefits, Zoom has drawbacks, and circuit courts have an affirmative obligation when dealing with a Zoom hearing to ensure that a person's access to counsel is not impeded.
Okay, I agree with all of that. Tell me how the court should deal with Zoom hearings going forward. That's the second time I asked the question. So let's try it.
So I think it's clear that we recognize their utility, but we provide those cautions and those guardrails.
And how are the cautions provided? How and what are the guardrails?
The guardrail is a person has a right to meaningfully access and confidentially consult with their attorney.
And I think asking how. How? Are you saying clear the courtroom? Are you saying set up a separate Zoom? How? We're interested in the mechanism.
I don't think the court has to mandate a specific mechanism because, again, as I pointed out, there's alternatives. What the rule the court has to comply with is it has to ensure the person has a meaningful opportunity to confidentially consult with their attorney. It has to conduct that proceeding in the same way it would conduct a live proceeding, which again, if Mr. Grady was in person and he wanted to whisper to his attorney, he could do that. He can't do that because he's on Zoom. If he wanted to pass a note, he could do that. He cannot do that.
But that goes back to what Justice Rebecca Bradley was saying, which was, and I don't think anyone up here like disagrees with that, that a client should be able to communicate with his or her attorney, but it is different when someone is appearing on Zoom. And so I agree with Justice Rebecca Bradley when she says, well, if every time someone wanted to confer privately with their attorney on Zoom, you'd have to stop and either clear the courtroom or stop and get a different whatever that extra room is called in Zoom, not the waiting room, but the private room, whatever. You'd have to stop and do something if it's every single time. And if you don't do it one time, you're violating someone's due process rights. Like I think everyone up here is like, we want to work with you. We want to figure out how to do this, but we need some sort of guidance on how to make this happen because it just isn't to tell circuit court judges around the state that when someone is appearing by Zoom, every time they want to talk to their attorney confidentially, you have to clear the courtroom so they can do that and then bring everyone back in.
So I disagree that it's impractical to tell circuit court judges that they have to respect a person's ability to confidentially consult.
I'm pretty sure I didn't say that. And if we can rewind Wisconsin Eye. That's not what I said was impractical. What is impractical? Let me be really clear. It is impractical if now I want to talk to my attorney, so everyone needs to clear the room. And then you come back in and something else happens. And then a minute later, I need to talk to my attorney and everyone here has to clear the room. That is impractical. It's not impractical. That the mechanism, the how we're trying to figure out how to do this in a courtroom in real life.
So when Mr. Grady manifested his desire to speak with his attorney, the obligation on the court at that point was to give him an option that would have given him the opportunity to avail himself of that access to counsel. That's what the circuit court needed to do.
What do you make of the factual finding here that this was not intended to be confidential? It just feels like he says, I want to talk to my attorney, starts talking to his attorney. Trial court says, we can hear you. And then ends up doing a hearing later and concluding this was not intended to be confidential. And so what you're asking us to say is that that his due process rights were violated, even though that he never intended to have a confidential conversation with his attorney. He was warned he was being heard. And because the trial court didn't offer him an opportunity to have a confidential conversation, that he never intended to be confidential. That feels like an odd holding for us as a court.
So I think the focus is earlier in the play-by-play. I think focusing on what happens when this warning is given is already to some extent too late. Because again, we're focused on the court's structural choices that when Mr. Grady asked to speak with his lawyer, it was incumbent upon the court to provide that meaningful opportunity. It didn't. It chose a procedure, again, where Mr. Grady had to make the untenable choice.
Do you know that? Do we know in the record that neither him nor his attorney were made aware of any possibility of having confidential conversations?
So the court certainly never found that it provided those options. The court indicated it was aware of the options. I think if the court had provided those options, it would have said so in its factual finding.
So the court needs to say it and make a finding in that? Or you're saying, did the attorney here have no knowledge that there was the ability to have a private conversation with his client?
So I think part of the problem here is due also to the structural choice the court made and why this solution, so to speak, was ineffectual, just going off the record and dealing with all of this off the record. Because we're not...
But you're saying the due process violation happened earlier. So you're saying the due process violation was the fact that the trial court didn't, communicate ahead of time, didn't, give him a handout and say, if you want to talk with your attorney, that is a structural due process violation that requires reversal and a new hearing because the lack of information that we don't even know if information was or wasn't given about that possibility?
So I don't think there's been any... And I see my red light is on.
Go ahead and finish your
I think if the circuit court had provided those options, it would have said so in its factual findings. And I think its factual findings impliedly support that it did not give those options. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I think the discussion we've been having here about what the court's duties were in this situation is sort of taking it beyond what the threshold question here is, really, when the court asked...
Excuse me. Just a moment. We won't fine her.
Yeah. I don't know if it's the president or the Pope calling, but it might be...
Someone important.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that.
It's okay. When the court asked Mr. Grady, after he sort of interrupted his counsel's argument and said, wait, what? And they said, the court or the judge said, do you need to talk to your attorney? And he said, yes. So they went off the record. There's nothing wrong with that. That's not a due process violation. The threshold issue here is whether Mr. Grady intended his communication with attorney-client to be confidential. Now, that intent can be demonstrated, in a very simple way. It's not a legalistic concept. It doesn't require his knowledge of the technology of the breakout room or the Zoom, what the different options are on Zoom. Basically, he just had to say, wait a minute, I don't want to speak in front of everyone. The court's findings of fact in its post-conviction.
Yeah, but maybe he assumed he was having a private conversation, right? I mean, you've got somebody in custody. He's the only player that's not in the courtroom. We know he's got mental health issues. I mean, I think that might be a stretch to expect him to do that.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's a stretch. In this case, it's just based on the facts. It's a case-by-case basis that we determine whether the confidentiality of the attorney-client privilege in 905.03 applies. Grady has the burden to show that he intended that conversation to be confidential. That underlies everything else here because there's no structural deficit in this hearing if it was clear that he did not intend to speak confidentially to his attorney. He was found competent to proceed, and the incompetency issue, I think, is a red herring here.
Are you saying he waived that?
No, Your Honor, no. I'm not saying there was a waiver. I'm not saying that he, I would say that it was never, that's the threshold issue of whether he wanted to talk to his attorney privately.
And the factual findings of the court that we need to defer to, right?
Precisely, yes, Justice Ziegler. It is, the factual findings of the court were very specific that Grady knew, I mean, it was obvious to everyone that he could be heard. And the court ensured that he knew that by what has been described as a warning. But, you know, it was just, it was an obvious fact that he could be heard. He was on Zoom, and the court was aware that there were options to go off the record or to provide a breakout room. Didn't provide those options, and that was not a due process violation because he, Grady, did not have any intent to have a private communication with
counsel.
Go ahead, Justice.
Okay, we don't, because it was off the record, we don't know exactly when and what things were said. So we don't know how much he said before he was told we can hear you. Is that a problem for you?
Your Honor, I don't believe that's relevant either here, that we don't know when it was, when the warning was given, because I don't think the warning was dispositive either. I mean, there's findings of fact, which were not clearly erroneous, that that Grady, it was obvious, Grady knew he was on Zoom. Okay. He was communicating over a microphone.
So you don't think the warning's dispositive. So just being on Zoom, a man in prison who's not in the courtroom, who's the only one in the Zoom where everyone else is in person, should understand that everything he says can be heard by everybody?
That was the finding of fact by the court, yes. I would say that was not clearly erroneous. It's not been argued that the defendant did not know, was unaware of the situation of being on Zoom. I'm not sure if the record shows whether there is any other times he was on Zoom. I know that he did choose to be on Zoom for this hearing, for what that's worth. That's reflected multiple times in the record that, and he had appeared in person at his plea and sentencing and at, I believe, at his competency hearing where he was found competent. So he's on Zoom. I mean, it's technology, yeah, but it's also common sense.
But can't we assume that when you ask to have a conversation with your attorney, you mean to have it confidential?
Your Honor, I don't believe that's a presumption. I believe it does have to be shown to be intended to be confidential. That's in 905.03. That's in the Meeks case. The defendant or the person invoking the privilege, in this case, the defendant, the client, has the burden to show that it was confidential before any non-disclosure applies.
Counsel,
please,
you're
in the queue.
Sorry.
I love it.
I wanted to ask your friend on the other side seems to be making a different argument, maybe than perhaps so originally. You're pointing out that that there needs to be a showing that this was intended to be confidential. We've got factual findings otherwise that are not clearly erroneous. But your opposing counsel said, actually, the due process problem is earlier. The due process problem seems to have nothing to do with the actual interaction that occurred, but something structural with the hearing about the presentation of options, that the failure of options to be presented, communicated, and the trial court make findings of fact constitutes a structural due process violation, regardless of whether there was an intent to have a confidential conversation at all. And I would like to hear your response to at least that version of the argument, which strikes me as maybe a bit different than we saw in the briefing.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that there was a structural deficit in this hearing. The court conducted the hearing and was in control of how the courtroom was run. Zoom is prevalent. The fact that he appeared on Zoom does not automatically give rise to some extra burden on the court. The court determines whether it's appropriate to go off the record, whether in this case, because it was on Zoom, whether it needed to provide options for confidentiality, but determining based on its assessment of the situation being in the courtroom, we need to defer to that, that Grady didn't want privacy. He wanted to speak to his counsel and he could have said, wait, I don't want to talk in front of everyone. But did not. So I don't think there is any structural problem with this hearing. To call it a due process violation seems to elevate this beyond what it could be, is that, well, maybe the court did have a better choice, but that is not required. My friend has talked a lot about the court has an obligation, a duty, a responsibility, but where does that come from? It comes from, if it exists, if the defendant, Grady in this case, had met his burden to show or met his burden to indicate that it was, he wanted confidentiality, he wanted privacy.
Counsel, I asked your opposing counsel if he should prevail, whether or not we get to ineffective assistance of counsel. What's your view of that?
I agree that they are two separate issues. The ineffective assistance issue, obviously the remedy for that, should the court find that it was sufficiently pled or that the record doesn't conclusively demonstrate that he wasn't prejudiced, is to remand for a Mockner hearing. Then
if he prevails on a Mockner hearing, then what happens?
That's a good question.
The answer is he gets a restitution hearing.
Right. Then he gets the restitution hearing, the contested restitution hearing.
That's right. So with both claims, the remedy is a restitution hearing. So let me ask, do you have an opinion whether or not, if he should prevail, that we need to address the ineffective assistance of counsel? It's okay if you don't have an opinion, but I just want to know if you do.
I would say I don't necessarily have an opinion on that. As I'm thinking about it right now, I feel like, yes, they would both have to be addressed.
That's okay. I have a follow-up question that's perhaps distinct. But here you have, I thought, two arguments on due process. One is communication with the attorney, and then the second was what was heard during the communication was indeed used by the prosecutor to advance an argument. And so if it wasn't in and of itself a separate violation, it was at least, I thought, was being argued an exacerbation of the first alleged violation. What, if any, import in the analysis in this case is the fact that the prosecutor used the information to advance the prosecution?
Your Honor, I agree with you that it is a two-part argument as to, you know, what happened with the communication between Klein and Grady. As to the first part, it had to be confidential for the court to have any kind of duty to, you know, clear the courtroom, you know, provide a breakout room, because as many of you have pointed out, that could be very onerous if every time someone says, you know, I'd like to talk to my counsel, we need to, you know, clear everyone out. Secondly, the prosecutor heard what he said. It was disclosed to third parties. The definition of confidential is not intended to be enclosed to third parties. He talked about being able to work and being, you know, in the past being responsible to pay a large amount of traffic ticket fines. And the prosecutor referenced that when he was arguing about his ability to pay, but basically to give him credit to say, look, he's taking responsibility for this. It's not, there was no violation of any rights there, because the prosecutor certainly didn't think that this was private. He heard it. It was disclosed to third parties. So it's two parts, but they are connected. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, the threshold question is whether this was a confidential communication. And the Court of Appeals was correct when it found that there was never any indication, intent of this being confidential.
What about that it was off the record? I mean, I just thought about that. Like, as a prosecutor, you're going to take some statements made off the record with the guy and his attorney and think that's okay to argue those? I mean, that just doesn't seem right, for lack of a better word.
Your Honor, I mean, it's maybe it wasn't the best thing to do, but again, it's not a violation of his attorney-client privilege rights, because 905.03 clearly requires that it was intended to be confidential. But if you read the transcript closely, which I've done a lot, you know, the prosecutor, as I mentioned, you know, references it, makes a comment about what he heard, which was not privileged, was not confidential. to his credit, you know, he said he could do this, and he doesn't use that directly to argue he can pay the full amount for sure. You know, he says, we hope that you will at least compensate the citizen for the $500 damage to their car, and the insurance company, maybe all of it, maybe some of it. You know, so it was a restitution hearing. It was done informally. The court, in its decision to order the full amount of restitution, focused on the fact that he was responsible for that full amount, and that he had family support, that it was stretched over quite a period of time. It was a, you know, somewhat large amount, but it wasn't insurmountable. So to answer your question about what the second part of this is, about what the prosecutor did, it wasn't perfect, but it wasn't a violation of his right to a fundamentally fair hearing.
One of my concerns is, in a court such as this, courts of last resort, and the court system in its entirety, I guess, sometimes we deal with assumptions, sometimes we deal with hypotheticals. I see this argument beyond that, and it's line drawing, and all seven of us may draw it differently. I see your position, or a position, that this defendant should have said, no, Your Honor, I want a confidential communication. Given that he had a history of mental health issues and very shortly thereafter was committed for mental health reasons, it's antithetical to reality to expect most or many people, but especially in this situation where it's a Zoom and competency issues are questionable, to expect him to invoke confidentiality. I mean, that's, to me, that goes beyond reason. So tell me why my meter should be shifted a bit, and tell me why it's perfectly reasonable.
Your Honor, I believe it's reasonable to expect any defendant, whether they're appearing in person or whether they're on Zoom. And I think we need to look at this holistically and not just necessarily say this is only on Zoom, that the defendant has to demonstrate intent to have a private conversation. If he was in person and he sat at the counsel table, court went off the record, you want to talk to your attorney, you started talking out loud, it would be the same result here, that prosecutor
heard
it.
Yeah, but if he started talking out loud, the circuit court would say, tone it down, we can all hear you, right? He'd be admonished, and I understand there was a certain admonishment here, but I think that you're sitting in a Zoom room in an institution by yourself, and you're watching these proceedings, and your attorney's already not performing, I would say, in a particularly zealous manner. Don't you think you can count on the judge to ensure that you have a fair hearing? And I think that's what concerns me about this.
I certainly think that the judge needs to provide a fair hearing. I'm not disputing that whatsoever. In this case, the hearing was not fundamentally unfair. It wasn't necessarily a perfect hearing. And I think what this court can do is look at it and say, okay, like maybe we provide some guidance on when, whether on Zoom or in person, it's appropriate to provide a means for a private communication with counsel. On Zoom, I understand there are kind of a different set of circumstances, and it could be, you know, that the court should do this. In this case, it didn't do it. Is that a due process violation? I just don't think it rises to that level. It was not fundamentally unfair for him to talk to his attorney while he was on Zoom, and then realizing, as the court found, clearly he knew that he could be heard. I understand we can have some dispute with that. Maybe he didn't understand because of his mental health issues. I think we have to take a step back from that, though. He was found competent to proceed. We have to look at what occurred, the time frame in which this occurred. The court didn't have a lens into the future to know that he would be found incompetent post-restitution, post-sentencing, pre-post-conviction proceedings. The court was very aware that he had issues, referenced it numerous times at sentencing, at the plea hearing, at sentencing, at the restitution hearing, you know, saying that I'm aware of the situation here, I'm taking that into account. Mm-hmm. I don't think this was any type of unfairness on the part of the court. It was trying to control its courtroom, give him a chance to talk to his attorney, make sure you know you can hear, you can be heard. And at that point, it's not too much to ask for anyone to who has the burden to show that it was confidential to just say, oh, wait, like, I don't want to be heard. I don't think that's creating too much of a burden on defendants who appear on Zoom to have to still demonstrate an intent to have a confidential communication with their counsel before any type of obligation on the part of the court kicks in to, okay, let's hold the phone, let's stop, go off the record, or, you know, not go off the record, you're already off the record, but, you know, set up a breakout room. I don't quite understand all of it either, but I know that there would be a way. And the court was aware of that. And the court also mentioned and made findings that Attorney Klein was aware of that too, that she had appeared in his courtroom numerous times and that she had, he believed, you know, been a part of a situation where there was a breakout room created. You know, how that factors into this, obviously there was no ineffective assistance claim made related to this. Not sure why, but I mean, maybe that would have been a way to approach this as well. But to call it a due process violation, that's a stretch, I think. And this court conducted a fair hearing. Grady received the process he was due, and the, you know, determination that he was responsible for the restitution to compensate the victim in this case, which the city of Muskego through its insurance company, that was sound, and he was ordered to pay that, and they want to undo it. So I think that ordering a new restitution hearing in this case is just not required, and this court should decline to do so. Does the court have any further questions regarding this issue? Or we could also talk a little bit about the ineffective assistance issue if that.
First, do you have any thoughts about the superintending authority of the courts to be able give guidance as to how to conduct these types of hearings?
Yeah, so basically whether the court could provide, you know, kind of guidance and, you know, I think the problem with creating any type of rule in this case is that it is a case-by-case analysis. To say, okay, court, always when, you know, there's any indication of wanting to speak to counsel, you got to do this. You got a breakout room. You got to go off the, you know, you have to provide privacy. I mean, the case law is very clear that whether something is confidential and whether privacy applies to attorney-client communication is case-by-case basis. It's not one size fits all. And so that would be a difficult thing to, you know.
Well, what about just saying something like in this type of situation when using Zoom or other media type settings that there has to be the offer to provide confidential communication without specifying what that necessarily means and leaving it up to the courts to determine how to do, but at least an offer. So when someone says, I want to talk to my attorney, I'm offering to make this confidential and this is how. These are possible ideas, but we could just make any offer.
I think that's reasonable. And I think this court, in its opinion, could say that, not find there was a due process violation, not order a new restitution hearing in this case, but say that, you know, this would be the better practice for the court to do this. The court should or must, I guess, you know, provide a confidential option going forward.
The court found, right, that at least they were aware of the options, the attorney was.
Yes.
So I mean, it just strikes me as pretty, what are we supposed to do? Tell the trial court, hey, you know, everybody knows this, but we're admonishing you for not communicating something that you already know and have availed yourself of in the past. I'm trying to figure out what the whole That doesn't make sense to me.
I think that, yeah, I think there is a problem with that because the court did make, you know, and the factual findings of the court are undisputed and not clearly erroneous. And one of the findings was that, you know, both Grady and his counsel knew that there were, or the, both Grady and his counsel knew that they could be heard, but also that his counsel, Attorney Klein, had practiced in the court on Zoom and knew that there were options for breakout rooms. There was just no indication on either part, either by Grady or by his counsel on his behalf, to say, let's make this private.
I mean, structural error is a pretty significant kind of finding, I mean, holding by the court. I mean, you know, it, which is why we usually require objections for different issues along the way so we can, you know, address them. And we see obviously all these other things. So, you know, trying to figure out what the structural due process violation would be for a non-confidential communication as found by the court, that the court warned about, that findings were made that the opposing counsel or that the that his own counsel knew that there were options to have private conversations. And we're going to say it was still a structural error in a due process violation for the court to not do something else that maybe would have been good, but like, you know, darn shucks, you should do better isn't due process.
Yes. And I fully agree with what you have just stated. I believe that was the, and that is definitely the position the state is taking. And I took in my brief. It's not a due process violation in this case. There's no structural deficit in the hearing. The court conducted the hearing, did what in the moment it figured that it had needed to do, made it finding a fact that it was clearly no intent to have a confidential conversation if you're speaking in front of everyone on Zoom, and that he was aware of that and made aware of that, ensuring that he was aware of that, but yet he's continued to speak about how he could work and had paid things in the past. He didn't want it to be private. I don't, you know, that's, that was the conclusion the court made on these specific facts. So to go back to your statement that is this a structural error on the part of the court? I think absolutely not. There's no structural deficit in how the court conducted this hearing. If the court has no further questions.
What about the second claim? You were going to touch on that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. The attorney-client privilege issue, I think, you know, the argument is made by Grady's counsel that Klein was performed deficiently for stipulating to the entire amount of restitution that he owed as a result of his crimes, which was in, I mean, there was other things too, but this particular one was the damage to the city of Muskego police car. This was handled by the insurance company, which is, you know, very common and I think, you know, not shocking. And the insurance company requested the entire amount of restitution for which he was responsible for, which was just over $19,000. $1,000 of that was the city's deductible, which the record is not super clear whether the city had paid that. We can kind of assume, I guess, that it had, and that, but what is clear is that the insurance company's affidavit in support of its restitution request said that after our insured's deductible is satisfied, then we get paid for the rest of the restitution checks will come directly to the statewide insurance company, the city of Muskego's insurance. The court made findings that showed that the insurance company could request both the damages that it had paid for the repairs to the police car, as well as the deductible. This is based on their contractual relationship, principles of subrogation law. I mean, the insurer is in the shoes of the insured, and they have an obligation to then reimburse the city for that $1,000. The argument that statewide was somehow would be unjustly enriched by receiving this $1,000 that they didn't pay just doesn't make sense because they are the insurance company that's going to reimburse their insured for that amount. So that's the legal argument. But really what it comes down to is whether Attorney Klein was performed efficiently by stipulating. Was that unreasonable? Was it beyond the, you know, what a reasonable attorney would do? I mean, it's a very high standard. it's insufficiently pled because there's, it's just, it wasn't unreasonable because that's the amount of restitution he was responsible for. Similarly, he was not prejudiced because he was responsible for the full amount of restitution. You know, we could get into the logistics of how that would happen if she had objected and then they had a contested restitution hearing and then the court found that, oh yeah, that 1,000 is not properly restitution to the insurance company, then the city files a claim. But his the contention that he would have saved $1,000 if she had stipulated, therefore he was prejudiced, just has no basis. There's, you know, both on this record and legally, the performance of Klein by stipulating to the entire amount of restitution that was due didn't rise even close to the level of deficiency. And Grady was not prejudiced because he was responsible for the full amount of restitution under our restitution laws, which require, you know, compensation to victims as a result of the defendant's crimes. I think I have a couple more minutes, but if there's no further questions.
I don't think so.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Rebuttal? Oh, your light just went on anyway, so.
All right, counsel, I just want you to start off and tell me what facts in the record would you point to in order to show that the conversation was intended to be confidential?
So I think in this case, we have to look at what happened and be realistic about it. Mr. Grady expressed his desire to consult with his attorney. The court acceded to that request by pausing the proceedings so that he could do so. I think under those circumstances, in this type of a hearing, a request that I consult with my attorney is a sufficient invocation of, I want to consult confidentially with my attorney. So, and I also think it's important, I appreciate opposing counsel clarifying that there are, I think, two issues here that are kind of being intertwined and perhaps mixed together. And as I see it, there are two issues with the ability to pay hearing, right? There's the structural deficit, which is the imposition of the untenable choice, as I've discussed. And then I think separate from that, in some ways connected to it, is the Meeks violation, which occurs then when the prosecutor is allowed to listen in on the conversation and use those communications against Mr. Grady in its legal argument.
I'm sorry, I just want to go back to Justice Protasewicz's question. So are you challenging that the trial court's finding that this was not intended to be a confidential conversation? Are you challenging that factual finding?
I think that Mr. Grady's request to speak with his attorney was sufficient to convey his intent that he communicate confidentially with us.
I kind of need a yes or no. Are you challenging whether the factual finding by the trial court that this was not intended to be a confidential conversation?
To the extent that that factual finding ignores that initial invocation by Mr. Grady, yes.
Okay, so your argument is that when somebody requests to talk with their attorney, so the trial court found that even though he kept talking despite the warning, you're saying that factual finding is just clearly erroneous?
So I think the court was also focused on that later exchange, which occurs off the record, where the court says, I warned him. Again, we don't know how the court warned him. We don't know when the court warned him. We don't know, you know, whether Mr. Grady heard the warning. We have no means of assessing the sufficiency of that warning. And as I pointed out, I think that's a problem in and of itself, that if the court is choosing, if its solution to Mr. Grady's invocation is to, quote unquote, go off the record and deprive us of an ability to assess the sufficiency and adequacy of the warnings, which is going to find to be dispositive in this case, is in and of itself a problem.
Here. Okay. I just want to nail down on exactly what you think the structural issue is again. So let's assume that we disagree with that the finding is clearly erroneous. Okay. This was found by the trial court to not intend to be a confidential conversation. We're going to take the trial court's finding that Grady's counsel knew that there were options to have private conversations and confidential conversations available, didn't object. So you're saying, so I want you to take those facts for a moment. If you want to challenge them, though you didn't formally do it in your briefing, but if you take them, we'll put this, just take those as they are for a minute. What exactly is the structural problem that the trial court should have done? He should have communicated something to that Grady's counsel already knew. He should have provided information. He should have said something at the time. Because you're saying it was not about even that in change. It was that exchange. It was something even further back. What was it? What is exactly the structural due process violation you're asking this court to find?
The structural due process violation is the deprivation of the channel to communicate confidentially with his attorney.
But the trial court found that Grady's counsel knew that. So that wasn't unknown, given those facts. So what exactly did the trial court fail to do that made this fundamentally unfair, even though Grady's counsel knew that option was available?
I think trial counsel's knowledge is not relevant to whether the court erred in how it chose to conduct this hearing.
So it's a fundamentally unfair hearing, even though for the trial court not to do something, even though Grady's attorney knew that confidential communications were available if requested.
So just as the attorneys in the Washington case would know that their attorney being in a box with a bailiff is an impediment to their confidential communication, it's not relevant to whether the structure that the court has chosen for this hearing to proceed under, whether that structure is deficient. And it is, because again, I'm sorry, my light is on.
Finish
answer.
Your sentence.
Mr. Grady cannot even whisper or pass a note. He is totally dependent on the circuit court's provision of a channel to communicate, and that is the issue.
Thank you very much. Interesting oral argument. The court is adjourned. We will convene in closed conference at 1:30.